the state is charging that Mr. Chuckwuck sexually assaulted the victim while she was incapacitated.
A Bristol Bay Native Corporation board member is charged with sexual assault. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the lone survivor of a 2010 Coast Guard helicopter crash talks about the accident for the first time.
So the morning of the mishap, we all woke up, we had breakfast at a hotel in Astoria. We were all very motivated to get back home.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
A board member for the Bristol Bay Native Corporation has been charged with sexually assaulting a female. 45-year-old Sergi Chuckwuck of Naknek is accused of assaulting the woman on November 5th. This morning, he appeared before the magistrate in Dillingham telephonically from the courthouse in Naknek. Assistant District Attorney Mari Carpinetti.
The state is charging that Mr. Chuckwuck sexually assaulted the victim while she was incapacitated or unaware that the assault was going on.
The state intended to charge Chuckwuck with felony sexual assault, but had to go with a lesser misdemeanor charge because they did not present the felony charge to grand jury within the specified period of time. They hope to eventually bring a felony charge, but that may change. On Sunday, the Bristol Bay Borough Police responded to reports of a shooting in Naknek that resulted in a fatality. The victim of that shooting is also the victim of the sexual assault. The details of the shooting are being withheld on account of the victim's status in the sexual assault case. The Borough Police say the shooting is under investigation and the victim's body has been sent to the state's medical examiner's office. Carpinetti says the question now is whether there is sufficient evidence to pursue the felony charge without the victim's testimony.
Given the way this case has developed, and in particular the death of the victim, right now we are evaluating how we can proceed because we have to make a determination of whether there's sufficient evidence. And obviously the death of the victim impacts that evaluation.
Chuckwuck was remanded back to custody and held on a $30,000 bail. A trial date was set for January. Bristol Bay Native Corporation says it is aware of the charges against Chuckwuck and is evaluating appropriate actions in light of the circumstances. In 2010, a Coast Guard helicopter crash in Washington State claimed the lives of three airmen from Sitka. Today, for the first time, we'll hear from the sole survivor of that incident, Lieutenant Lance Leone. First, some background. The MH-60 Jayhawk, known by its tail number 6017, had been upgraded in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. An air crew of four left Air Station Sitka to pick up the new chopper in Astoria, Oregon, and fly it back to Alaska. On July 7, 2010, during the first leg of that return flight, the helicopter struck wires near LaPush, Washington, and crashed into the sea. Lieutenant Sean Kruger, who was the pilot in command, along with Petty Officer First Class Adam Hoke and Petty Officer Second Class Brett Banks, were killed. Leone, the co-pilot, faced criminal charges in the aftermath of the crash. Those charges were dismissed, but an official reprimand was placed on his record, and he was transferred to a desk job in San Antonio, Texas. He spoke to KCAW's Ed Ronco last week. It is the first time he's talked on the record to any news organization, and we're going to bring you the interview in three parts. Today, we begin just before the crash, which wasn't too long after Leone transferred to Air Station Sitka.
I literally had just gotten there. I was still living in a bed and breakfast in the community because my household goods had not arrived yet. So all of our couches and, all of our stuff had not arrived yet from Elizabeth City because it was taking a barge around the whole world. I don't know where it went exactly.
It felt like the whole world.
It felt like that.
So if we can begin with when you first get to Astoria, I imagine, was it the morning of or the night before?
So we were assigned to fly down to Astoria in the tank, in the Juliet model, and then there was a 6017 was flying from Elizabeth City, which is an aircraft that I'd flown before quite a bit. It was flying across the country, and we were flying down from Sitka. We were going to rendezvous in Astoria, exchange paperwork on the two different aircrafts, and then the pilots were going to shake hands, swap aircraft, and then we were going to fly back to Sitka, and the other aircraft was going to fly back to Elizabeth City. It's an often done thing in the Coast Guard where our large depot maintenance is all done in Elizabeth City, so we have to switch our aircraft out.
What's it feel like to pick up a new chopper? I mean, is it like driving a car off a lot, or?
So it's an interesting, the 6017, I'd actually flown it the whole time I was in Elizabeth City. I had done most of the test flights on it when it came out of the depot maintenance. So I'd flown it once it was, so when we say it's brand new, it's like, I guess, a refurbished. We bought the 60s in 1991 through 1993, I believe, that time frame. And they're the same aircraft. Now, they look absolutely gorgeous always because we have some of the best maintainers in the world. But they're not brand new, but they are totally beautifully refurbished.
Leone says he was selected for the mission 2 days beforehand. He and Lieutenant Sean Kruger, the chopper's pilot, had met at the Coast Guard Academy in Connecticut. And although Leone had known Kruger most of his adult life, this would be one of their first times flying together. As co-pilot, Leone's responsibility is inside the cockpit to monitor equipment and navigate the helicopter along a safe course.
So the morning of the mishap, we all woke up. We had breakfast at a hotel in Astoria. We were all very motivated to get back home. The morning was fairly hurried because we knew we had a long way to go, 900 miles with a possible 20-knot headwind, depending on what altitude we were at, was going to make it a very long day. So we knew we had to get on the road. We got all the checklists completed, a lot of busyness on the ground. We took off, climbed up to 800 feet, and upon reaching 800 feet, we realized that we'd had a headwind that was predicted, and then we came right back down again at lower altitude. It was more of a offshore or onshore breeze, because there's cliffs all along that shoreway there. And flying up was just an absolutely gorgeous day.
The Jayhawk had been upgraded with a new avionics system. Those are the electronics that control the helicopter. It included a new autopilot. Leone refers to it as a coupler.
I was very excited to show him how you can engage it and it will fly itself as long as you keep it away from obstacles and have the right altitude. It will fly you safely to wherever you tell it to fly you.
By this time, Coast Guard Helicopter 6017 was nearing LaPush, Washington. The small town on the Olympic Peninsula is home to the Quileute tribe, as well as a small Coast Guard boat station.
We both saw something up ahead. It was a Coast Guard cutter leaving port. It was actually a Coast Guard small boat, a 47-footer leaving Quileute.
The helicopter was flying at about 220 feet when Kruger began moving it closer to the boat. Leone says it's a maneuver pilots often perform at sea when checking on fishing boats or spotting another Coast Guard vessel. The Coast Guard's report on the accident acknowledged that performing the maneuver is not isolated to this incident, but says vessels should not be, quote, zoomed, except in an emergency or during rescue operations. Leone describes the next 42 seconds when helicopter 6017 slowed to 115 knots, descended to 114 feet, and passed over the boat.
At this time, he said, coupler disengaged, and he started a right-hand turn down in a decreasing altitude along the coastline. And this point in the flight recorder, it gets very interesting because I say, well, that's Quileute. And I say it wrong. I can't read it. It's a very difficult world. It's like many Tlingit terms that are very hard for us to read in our language. But I said it, and on the third time of saying it, moments later, we hit with something that we never saw. And I was At that moment, everything changed.
That's Coast Guard Lieutenant Lance Leone, the only survivor of a Coast Guard helicopter crash that killed three airmen from Sitka in 2010. Tomorrow, Leone describes the accident and how it changed his life and his career forever. Political newcomer Jonathan Kreiss Tompkins has taken a 28-vote lead in the race for a state House seat from Southeast Alaska. The Democrat of Sitka now leads incumbent Republican Bill Thomas of Haines by 28 votes. The District 34 race had been tied. The Division of Elections this morning reported the new totals after counting 86 absentee ballots. 26 special absentee ballots need to be counted, along with any other eligible ballots postmarked from overseas that may arrive before a deadline Wednesday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the challenge of finding quality childcare in rural Alaska.
We don't have a daycare, a formalized daycare here, so that makes it very difficult.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at ArcticWireRope.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A light sheen has been spotted near two vessels that grounded off the Alaska Peninsula. The tug Polar Wind and the barge it was towing ended up on the rocks on Wednesday, and responders observed the pollution on Friday. Boom was laid out around the Polar Wind to contain the spill. The tug was carrying more than 20,000 gallons of diesel fuel at the time of the grounding. The barge that grounded with it was also transporting an estimated 1.5 million pounds of frozen seafood. According to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, generators on the barge are still running and the containers remain refrigerated. Responders are staging in Cold Bay and Sand Point, but rough weather prevented them from getting out to the accident site today. They're hoping to remove the remaining fuel from the vessels tomorrow and transfer the frozen seafood to another cargo vessel by the middle of the week. Ukolnai, where the vessels beached, is an uninhabited island that's designated critical habitat for Steller sea lions, Steller eiders, and sea otters. The Department of Environmental Conservation says there have been no reports of wildlife being affected by the spill. A think tank in Washington, D.C. is launching a program to elevate Native youth who show promise for shaping future Native policy. As APRN's Peter Grannis reports, it's looking to an Alaska Native woman for inspiration.
Tessa Baldwin started Hope for Alaska in high school after her boyfriend committed suicide as a junior. She traveled the state, visiting villages, sharing her story, and oftentimes alienating those who did not want to talk about a sensitive topic.
The elders in my village would look to me and say, "Why would you talk about this? You're going to cause our children to commit suicide if you talk about this."
Baldwin is now a freshman at the University of California, San Diego. She says she misses the cold weather in Kotzebue, her home. This week, she's in Washington, D.C., serving as the model for a new program called Champions for Change. It's an initiative of the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute.
This actually started last year when 11 of us youth went to the White House to meet the president to talk about our stories of how we overcame the struggles.
The struggles of suicide have ripped at Baldwin for years. Not only did her boyfriend take his life, so did an uncle. She says all over the state, in every village she visited, people opened up to her about the suicide of a friend or family member. Former Senator Byron Dorgan founded the Center for Native American Youth. He also chaired the Senate Indian Affairs Committee while he represented North Dakota. He says what he witnessed in years of travel in Indian country belie the myths from outside, and that's a key reason for starting Champions for Change.
It's just an opportunity to show the country a different face of what is so often reported. They so often report the challenges the bad news. But I'm telling you, I think there are some remarkable young people doing great, great things and inspirational things on the reservations as well.
Senator Dorgan says many of the details of the program need to be fleshed out, but all the young adults chosen will be flown to Washington, D.C. to share their stories with the White House. The Champions for Change program is looking for applicants who show promise in the future of Indian policy, those who have emerged as young leaders, those who have overcome personal and emotional trouble. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
It's the 70th anniversary of the start of the Lend-Lease program. The World War II-era U.S. aid effort included the transfer of thousands of American-made planes to Russia from Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, Lend-Lease has had a lasting impact on the interior city and fellow air hub communities in the Russian Far East.
Fairbanks was a much smaller city prior to World War II, an event that grew the population by 200%. Fairbanks Pioneer Air Museum curator Pete Haglund says the Lend-Lease program triggered a boom.
It was busy all the time. I mean, the airport was here. We had lots of troops came in. It started out pretty small and then ended up with, I think, about 5,000 or 6,000 troops assigned to the ATC Transport Ferrying Command.
Haglund says half of all the planes sent to Russia came through Fairbanks.
There were 7,926 officially airplanes that went over to Russia through Fairbanks. And from 1942, late September, to 1945, September. In times, there were over 300 airplanes went through here a month.
U.S. pilots ferried the new planes, a range of fighters, trainers, cargo, and bomber aircraft, from a staging area in Montana to Ladd Field at what became Fort Wainwright. Haglund says once on post, the Russian military would inspect the new aircraft and final work would be completed before the planes officially changed hands.
They would bring them in one end of the hangar, paint the red star on them, and take them out the other end of the hangar, and that's when they were turned over to the Russians.
Hangar 1 at Fort Wainwright is now a National Historic Monument. Haglund says modifications were made on some aircraft, including one born of basic necessity on a transport plane.
Of course, the heat was always limited, and it was always pretty cold over in Siberia in the wintertime. So they actually put a stove in there, wood or coal stove, and ran the chimney out the side of the airplane up over the top. And so they added a little cabin heat.
Haglund says the Russian flight crews often stocked up at Fairbanks stores to bring home food and other supplies to war-rationed communities at home. The Russian pilots would fly from Fairbanks, sometimes stopping in Galena, and then on to Nome, where they'd wait for a weather window to cross the Bering Strait into Russia, followed by a long series of flights to the Western War Front. The Lend-Lease story was largely kept quiet until Russia opened up beginning in the late 1980s, and Alaska and Russian Far East communities reconnected. Fairbanks and the fellow Lend-Lease air hub of Yakutsk became sister cities. Mimi Chapin, secretary of the Alaskan Russian Center in Fairbanks, which works to foster the relationship, went to Yakutsk again last year and met with a local Lend-Lease historian.
One of the things that he said that was most interesting to me was that people during that time did not talk about the fact that it was really, really dangerous and that many planes went down and a number of people were killed. They didn't want to admit failures of any kind. And he felt that one of the important contributions he was making was allowing people to remember members of their family that had died in the attempt to bring these planes over.
Chapin, who laid a wreath on the Yakutsk Lend-Lease Memorial during her visit, says the World War II-era program has had a lasting local impact on the U.S.-Russian relationship.
They said that they had memories of, in very small villages on the outskirts of Yakutsk, receiving boxes of food that had, when they opened up the box, it had made in the USA and it was Lend-Lease program. And this gave them a really positive feeling about Americans.
The 70th anniversary of Lend-Lease is being marked in Yakutsk and Fairbanks. A Lend-Lease ceremony and symposium were held in Fairbanks over the weekend. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Enroll now and get a career in less than a year in refrigeration, marine oiler, heavy equipment, or welding. Additional training programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January. This message sponsored by Aptec.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
November is usually the second snowiest month in Anchorage, but this year snow totals are well below average. So far, only about 3 inches of snow has fallen in the city. November usually sees an average of 7 inches by now, with a total of a little more than 13 inches for the month. National Weather Service meteorologist Dave Snyder says total snowfall for the season is well below normal.
Since July 1st, we are 8.6 inches of snow below normal. The average is about 15.3. So far, we have 6.7. So, give or take a little bit, we're about halfway there. Not so great.
Snyder says the culprit is a blocking pattern that essentially prevents new weather from moving in.
That pattern is something we've seen twice, kind of back to back, in the last 30 to 45 days. And because of that, it's really holding up the storm track and not getting those good storms into prime position to give us decent amounts of snow. That was not the case last year.
Last year was a record setter for Anchorage, and by this point in November, 19 inches had fallen in the city. Snyder says right now the blocking pattern is keeping cold, high pressure above Anchorage. He says they are tricky to forecast, but it doesn't look like the city will get any significant snow for at least a week. But Girdwood and Alyeska Resort are doing a little better than Anchorage. Alyeska is reporting 35 inches so far and is scheduled to open Wednesday. Finding quality, affordable child care for young children can be a challenge anywhere in Alaska. It's especially difficult in rural Alaska's hub communities, where the cost of living is high and space is often hard to find. It becomes a factor in attracting professionals to jobs at regional health and other organizations. In the next installment of our series, Being Young in Rural Alaska, from the producers of Kids These Days, Ann Hillman takes a look at how some communities are trying to meet the challenge.
At Ilisavik College in Barrow, President Pearl Bauer tries to concentrate on our interview, but she's a little distracted.
Do you want to go sit with Auntie Kayla?
Her 10-month-old daughter is crawling into the hallway. She had a babysitter problem this morning.
We don't have a daycare, a formalized daycare here, so that makes it very difficult because it's all personal caregivers.
Brower is not alone. April Blevin struggled to find childcare when she first moved to Bethel, where there are currently no licensed childcare facilities for children under three.
And when I went to visit houses that had babysitters, you would see one childcare provider with maybe up to 12 children. And in my eyes, it just was not a safe environment or one that I would want my child in.
So a cousin came to live with her.
And then the following year, me and about four other parents went in and through a nanny service, hired a nanny, and she came up. We provided housing, and she kept our five children.
Later, Blevins did find home care she was happy with. Marcy Bish, child care program manager for the state, says the biggest hurdle for many providers getting licensed is background checks. Every person living in the home must pass them, not just the primary care provider.
So a lot of times there's barriers that come up as part of those checks that do not allow somebody or a family member to move forward with the licensing process.
And many people do home daycare for only a few years while their own children are young. Childcare centers struggle to be able to pay decent wages, staff turnover is high, and it can be hard to find a qualified person to be the facility administrator under licensing rules. The costs add up to more than most parents can pay. Those are statewide issues. Even in urban areas, the best childcare programs are subsidized by employers. That's how April Blevins is trying to meet the need in Bethel. She works for the Lower Kuskokwim School District and manages its Busy Bees childcare program for children ages 3 to 5. School district employees have preference for spots at the school, and the waiting list is long. LKSD is opening a second facility for children as young as 6 weeks and expects it to be full right away. The staff is employed by the district, so they have better benefits than the independent facility could offer. And they have donated space.
If it hadn't have been for the Bethel Alternative School offering us a space, it would have been difficult for us to expand.
Families in Barrow and other North Slope communities are grappling with two problems: a lack of child care facilities and a loss of language. So staff at Ilisavik College created a combined solution, the Language Nest, an early childhood language immersion program. Teacher Tuukluk Diaz sings Row, Row, Row Your Boat in Inupiaq in a room that looks like a typical preschool, except every bit of the decoration, from the toy caribou to the dolls in the tent, reflect life on the North Slope.
The language, it's going to be put in their heart, instilled in their heart in the beginning, and it's going to go along in when they become adults.
The Language Nest just opened and eventually will accept students ages 0 to 3. While at the school, the kids will only listen to and speak Inupiaq.
You just say simple things, simple commands that you usually do in a home, and that's what we're going to do.
That's teacher Martha Stackhouse. She says that by teaching the children Inupiaq with words that they would typically use at home, they will also teach parents the language. And kids will only be accepted to the program if their parents commit to being involved in the classroom at least 8 hours per month. Program Director Mary Sage says the Language Nest is part of Ilisavik's larger Inupiaq Early Learning Degree.
Under the business track, there'll be some courses that will help them establish their own Language Nest in their home, anywhere on the North Slope.
Future teachers can earn school credits by working in the current Language Nest, and the college will teach how to get state daycare licenses. The North Slope Borough is also working to address the need, with a child care task force looking at reopening a borough-run facility. Across the state, as new health care centers and school buildings are built, advocates are pushing to add to the plans to make space for the care and education of the very youngest Alaskans. With help from Jessica Cochran, I'm Ann Hillman.
For more about the Being Young in Rural Alaska series, visit our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Barrow, and Jessica Cochran in Anchorage. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.